You're listening to an interview from the Jodcast. For the full show, visit www.jodcast.net.
Right, thank you very much for coming to talk to us about your research. And it's exciting research, isn't it? It's new, literally new.
It is. It's still going on in research, in fact. So it's something that it's an area that sort of began at least this time round in February. So in fact, when we came into work on the morning of Monday, the 13th of February, there was an email announcement, basically, that a star had exploded.
A star had exploded?
Yeah.
It sort of catches your eye amongst the email list, doesn't it? So stars blown up.
Well, funnily enough, stars do explode quite often, but this was actually a particular interest to us because it was a star that was well known to us. It's a star called Aras Ophiuchi. The name sort of comes from the constellation it's in. It's in the constellation of Ophiuchus, which is the serpent's bearer. Interestingly enough, that's the 13th sign of the zodiac. The sun spends more time in that constellation than it does in Scorpio.
That's so, right. I heard about this. There actually are 13 signs. Yeah, but this is astronomy and astrology, so we'll move quickly along.
So we knew this thing. We knew about this because it's actually exploded before. So that was why we were sort of interested to see this particular explosion go off again. So the last time it exploded was 1985, and this time around is 2006. So it's 21 years since it exploded before, and in fact, it's been seen quite a few times actually over the last century. So if you sort of go through them, the first time it was noticed was 1898, and then 1933, 1958, 1967, 1985. And now 2006.
So it's actually, it just goes bang quite regularly. So
roughly, if you went through those numbers there, you'd find that it wasn't absolutely regular, in fact. Otherwise, we could probably have predicted, exactly when this was going to go off again. But in fact, 21 years is a reasonably long time. The time before that was 18 years. So it was sort of overdue. In fact, funnily enough, we'd been discussing it a few weeks before and saying, it's 21 years since RS off went off. Maybe we ought to be looking out for it.
It's about time. You were intimately involved in a previous outburst, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Funnily enough, I did my PhD. I began in October 1985, my PhD. At Manchester, in fact, so not at Jodrell Bank, but in the city of Manchester, which is about 20 miles north of here. And the topic was the 1985 explosion of Aras Ophiuchi, because it went off in January of 1985.
Right.
So I basically worked for 3 years on modelling the explosion, so trying to make a sort of mathematical model of the explosion and compare the predictions that model had for the X-ray observations, largely, in fact, of that explosion. So it was sort of interesting. It's a story I used to tell, was that I spent 3 years working on this one star, and it was only several years after finishing my PhD I realised I had no real idea where it was in the sky at all, because it was a theoretical PhD.
So. A minor detail. So you literally wrote the book on this event, and it's gone bang again, which is must have been very exciting.
Right.
So what exactly is it? What's happened?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's noticed. It's actually spotted by Japanese astronomers. It becomes rather bright. So it brightens from a magnitude of about 11, which is invisible to the naked eye. It brightens to about a magnitude of 4.5, which makes it visible without a telescope. So, in fact, it literally would be a new star appearing in the sky.
That's what nova means, isn't it? Just incidentally, it just means new.
Yeah, it comes from Nova Stella, which is new star.
For all those Latin scholars out there, Nova Stella, new star.
Nova, pronounced with a Rochdale accent, so you could pronounce it. So it's actually not one star, though. Mm-hmm. This is the interesting thing. It was discovered in the 1960s, actually, that these objects are actually binary stars. There's two stars orbiting one another. In most novae, the one star is a sort of main sequence star, a bit like the Sun, maybe a bit lower mass than the Sun, and the other star is a white dwarf. So this is a star that used to be like the Sun, used to be a main sequence star, burning hydrogen into helium at its core.
Right.
It's expanded to become a red giant at some point in the past, lost all its outer layers, and what's left behind at the middle is the core of the star where all the nuclear reactions used to take place.
Right.
We call that a white dwarf. Mm. It's about the size of the Earth, but typically about the mass of the Sun,
right?
Something like that.
It's still a star, though, isn't it? Is it?
It's not actually. There's no nuclear reactions going on inside it anymore.
Right.
So really, it is a dead star. It's still very hot. They're typically very hot because they used to be the core of a star, so they're very hot. And gradually they cool down, but it takes many millions of years, perhaps billions of years, for these things to cool right down.
Right.
So they're still very hot things. So there you've got this binary star system, two stars orbiting one another. In a typical nova, the sort of separation of these two stars is about the size of the sun. So in fact, you could sort of almost fit both stars within the sun as they circle around one another.
So they're very, very close in astronomical terms there.
Yeah, absolutely. And what that means is that has important consequences, because it means that material from the what we call the secondary star, the other star, not the white dwarf, is sort of dragged off by the gravity of the white dwarf, falls onto the white dwarf's surface. And over probably thousands of years in these cases, that material builds up, a layer builds up, and at some point, if you can imagine being at the bottom of this layer of stuff, there's mostly hydrogen piling in on top of you. If you're at the bottom of this, the weight sort of builds up on top of you, the pressure increases, temperature increases, you get to the point where you can start thermonuclear reactions, similar to the ones that go on inside the sun, that power the sun. But it turns out the conditions are such that you don't have a sort of safety valve where once the nuclear reactions start, the sort of the gases sort of expands to limit the reactions. That safety valve isn't there, and so these reactions just run away very quickly into an explosion.
It's basically a bomb, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a huge hydrogen bomb.
Right.
That's what it is. And there's no point even trying to think about how huge it is, because it's so many orders of magnitude greater than the whole world's nuclear arsenal. It doesn't make much. It's enough in that explosion. Basically, the material that's sort of collected on the white dwarf is chucked off into space at maybe a speed of 1,000 kilometres a second or so.
Right.
And there's about an Earth's mass or so of material kicked off. So if you can imagine taking the whole of the Earth and having to the amount of energy needed to accelerate that from a standing start to 1,000 kilometres a second is the amount of energy that's in one of these explosions.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So why is it that the white dwarf accretes matter, draws matter off the nearby star? Why is it? Is it just because it's so close? Is gravity that strong? What's the process?
I mean, if you can imagine, there's possibly two mechanisms involved in this. One goes by the exciting title of Roche-Loeb overflow, which means that if you can imagine the sort of force of gravity between these two stars, you can imagine sitting at a point partway between them where it would more or less balance.
Right.
Okay. If what seems to happen is that the secondary star expands, the sort of main sequence star has filled what we call its Roche-Loeb, so there's part of the surface of the star reaches the point where it effectively sort of falls over. Past this point where the forces are balanced and falls down onto the surface of the white dwarf.
Right.
So that's what often goes on in these objects. Sometimes it can be just a process of gathering material from the wind of the other star. So stars have winds, the sun has a solar wind, there's particles, you know, being expelled by the star all the time, and some of that material could be captured by the gravity of the white dwarf. That's another way you can get material onto the white dwarf. In this case, in Aris Ophiuchi, it turns out it's slightly different, and in fact makes it quite interesting. The secondary star is not a main sequence star. It's already evolved. It's beyond that point of its evolution, and it's expanded to become a red giant.
Right.
So you've actually got a red giant and a white dwarf, but the same sort of process is going on. Materials captured from the red giant, either through this Roche-Loeb overflow process or through the accretion of wind, and we're not actually sure exactly what it is yet. And then this explosion takes place. What happens then in this case is when the stuff's thrown off, it runs into the wind of the red giant. So surrounding this whole system is this sort of dense, sort of extended atmosphere of this sort of red giant star.
Right. So the puffy outer layers.
Yeah, that's right. And so when this explosion goes off, it happens immediately. Stuff is chucked off and immediately starts to run into surrounding material. Now,
what happens then? It must be like a...
Yeah, well, what happens then is that material is shocked. It's chucked off so fast, and the speeds are something like maybe as much as several thousand kilometres a second. So that's sort of, you know, millions of miles per hour. It hits something, and that shocks it. That sends a shock wave, a blast wave, out through this red giant wind and back through the stuff that's been chucked out. So both things, you know, if you were thrown out, you'd feel an impact because you're hitting something.
Yeah,
it's
right.
The impact of the two things. And those shock waves heat the gas to temperatures of tens of millions of degrees.
Tens of millions of degrees.
So maybe 100 million degrees. Yeah. That gas is so hot, it generates X-rays. So in fact, we see Arasafuki after the outburst as a very bright X-ray source. It becomes a very bright source of X-rays in the sky.
Because X-rays in astronomy basically are an indicator, a signal to very, very high energy physics, very powerful things going on.
That's right. And also, we see radio waves from it. And what we found is that the radio waves that we see are explained by a mechanism that's called synchrotron radiation. Mm-hmm. And synchrotron radiation, in this case, it comes from electrons which have been accelerated by these shock waves to almost the speed of light. Mm-hmm. And as they sort of spiral around the magnetic field that must be present there, then they radiate radio waves in this case. And we see very bright radio emission from this explosion, from these shock waves as a result. Now, last time round, back in 1985, RSOF was observed in X-rays by a satellite called Exosat, which was the European X-ray satellite. And so we knew that there was going to be some bright X-ray emission. But of course, this time round, we were prepared for it. So, you know, the Monday morning of the 13th of February, we were ready. We knew we had to go and apply for time on these telescopes, mm-hmm. not just the X-ray telescopes, but radio telescopes as well, because we saw radio emission last time round. But this time, being ready for it, we could get even more powerful telescopes than we had 21 years ago, get them onto the case even quicker than we did last time, and hope to track the whole phenomena right from the start through to the finish of the outburst, which we didn't really manage to do last time. So sure enough, basically within a few days, X-ray emission was detected with several satellites, including the SWIFT satellite and the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer, RXTE, showing basically the emission from this very hot gas, this tens of millions of degrees shock-heated gas that was generated by the explosion. Mm. 2 weeks after the outburst, well, within 4 days of the outburst, we actually used the Merlin telescopes in the UK, which are the network of radio telescopes in the UK, actually detected radio emission from RSOF about 4 days after the explosion, which was actually a bit of a surprise, because last time round we didn't see anything until about 18 days after the explosion, so it took us by surprise a little bit.
Is that even though you were looking for radio emission before 18 days?
We didn't look after 4 days last time, it must be said, but we did see it brightening after 18 days, so we didn't expect it to come up until about a week or so after, so it sort of beat us by maybe a few days to a week, which surprised us a little bit. We quickly got onto the National Radio Astronomy Observatory's network of telescopes in the USA, the VLBA, which is a network of radio telescopes that spreads across from Hawaii to the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. We made an observation with that array 2 weeks after the explosion, which was the earliest that we could manage to do that. That was quite a quick response, in fact. And with that, we actually took an image that shows the shockwave itself. So although the X-ray observations indicate to us that there's this hot gas there, and we would interpret that as being the result of a shockwave, nobody before had been able to actually take a picture of that shockwave.
Right.
And the reason is because even though this shockwave's expanding at a speed of about 4 million miles an hour, so 2 weeks after the explosion, if that explosion had taken place on the sun, for example, not that it would, but if it had, luckily, that shockwave would have expanded out to be about the size of the orbit of, somewhere between the orbits of Saturn and Uranus. So it's a large shockwave at that time, but Arasafuki is maybe about 5,000 light years away.
Of course.
So if you took something that size and moved it to that huge distance, it actually appears incredibly tiny on the sky.
Right,
it's only
right.
5 millionths of a degree across.
So you wouldn't have been able to see it, it would just have been a spot.
So with an X-ray telescope, or even with an optical telescope, certainly with a normal optical telescope, you basically just see a point of light, a spot.
Right.
You don't resolve anything. With these huge radio telescope arrays, because they're spread across such large distances, they actually give us the highest resolution images in the whole of astronomy. You can see the smallest structures with those telescopes. So we could actually image this thing and see what was effectively a ring, which was this expanding shockwave.
And it wasn't a dot at all. It was actually, when you see it close enough.
When you see it close enough, it is a ring, and the size of it fits with the speed which we'd, inferred from the X-ray observation. So it's a really important observation in that sense, is to actually, really pin down what these models are otherwise predicting on from different parts of the spectrum.
So then? I mean, if you see a ring at a certain time, then surely a certain time later you
see a bigger ring.
Ah, see a bigger ring. Okay.
So in fact, the interesting thing is in this case that when we first saw the image, when we saw this ring, it was like, ah, there we go, it's a ring, it's what, you know, great, it's confirmed these theories. The sort of slightly strange thing about it is the ring is brighter, much brighter on one side than it was on the other. It's still not entirely clear to us why that is. We have some ideas about what that might be, but I don't think I would argue that we haven't fully pinned that down yet. What happened then is that ring got bigger, which is what we'd expect because the shockwave is expanding. You can actually measure an expansion speed from that, which is 1,700 kilometres per second, 4 million miles an hour. But also what happened is we saw extra bits of radio emission appear on first on one side of this ring,
right,
and then on the other side. So in fact, from starting off being something ring-like in the middle, it started to sort of elongate sideways in a sort of east-west direction.
What could possibly cause that?
Well, there's two possibilities, really. It could be that the explosion itself is not... the material's chucked off the white dwarf, not in all directions at once.
Right, it's not a perfect sort of sphere.
Yeah, not a perfect sphere, but maybe in opposite directions, so jets.
So
jets are seen in astronomy quite a lot. We see jets on galactic scales from supermassive black holes at the centres of these radio galaxies spew jets out in opposite directions. Some stellar sources, so X-ray binaries, for example, where you've got maybe a neutron star or something, or maybe even a black hole in a binary star system, also appear to shoot stuff out in opposite directions in jets. And this is the first... This could well be the clearest evidence we have so far in one of these type of systems, which is a sort of white dwarf binary of the existence of jets. It's not completely understood how these jets occur, and so that it's sort of important to try and find as many examples as you can in different conditions so that you can pin down exactly what the physics might be. So that's one possibility, is that it's jets. The other possibility is that actually maybe the explosion was more spherical, but then it gets shaped. So it's harder for it to expand in one direction than it is in another direction, and so gradually it becomes more elongated. And it could be that that's because this wind from this red giant that I've mentioned is actually sort of denser in one plane, maybe in the plane of the orbit of the binary.
So it's essentially easier for the explosion to go in a particular direction or two particular directions as opposed to outwards all the time.
And it just sort of gradually evolves to become this sort of elongated thing. And I think we need to, you know, work on the data a bit more and do some sort of calculations to see which of these might be most likely in this case.
And that's what brings us to the theoretical side of this work, is that you're trying to learn a lot about how stars behave in general. So we have winds and we've got jets and we have explosions and explosions and winds and jets and explosions and stars and all that sort of carry on. The modelling of these sort of things, the theory, trying to understand them from basic physical principles and using computers must be incredibly difficult.
It's not, well, as you know, it's not as difficult as, you know, I mean, I suppose it is difficult, but it's not you know, it's not obviously not impossible, and it's just it just relies on a sort of knowledge of physics. In this case, it relies on fluid dynamics, gas dynamics, for these sort of shock waves. So if you know, it's the same sort of physics that applies to, you know, aerodynamics of aeroplanes or cars or whatever, the sort of motion of a gas. And how that's... So the shock wave that I referred to earlier, in the case of aerodynamics, in the case of aeroplanes, that's basically what we call a sonic boom.
Right.
So when a plane moves at faster than the speed of sound through the atmosphere, then you get this shock wave that travels ahead of it, where, in effect, the gas ahead of it doesn't know the plane's coming.
Right.
Because it's moving faster than the speed of sound, and the sound waves that would travel through the air to let you know that something was on its way, you'd hear the noise of the engines coming towards you.
Yes.
The plane's actually moving faster than the sound of the engines. And so if you were sitting there quite happily as a bit of the atmosphere, all of a sudden you'd get a bloody great shock when the plane smacks into you. So it's a shock wave.
It would be shocking indeed.
So that's why it's called a shock wave.
So we understand things like planes and sort of ships going through water and stuff like that. It's all pretty much the same physics, you're saying.
Yeah, it's similar stuff. I mean, one of the areas that's still not that well understood in this case is, I mentioned particles being accelerated at the shock wave, and that's a bit of physics that's still quite hard to really understand. So again, these sorts of observations where we infer that this particle acceleration process must be going on is giving us a bit of insight into that physics and helping to constrain the development of those sorts of models.
And that's particularly what you work on here, isn't it? It's the development of the models of these stats.
Yeah, lots of other things, but... yeah, we sort of combined. We do quite a lot of calculations of the sort of gas dynamics of these explosions and the way in which the material is ejected. So we can combine these observations that we've been doing with those models to try and refine our understanding. I mean, it seems that jets. I don't know whether anybody's seen these nice pictures of planetary nebulae that the Hubble Space Telescope's been taking over recent years, very pretty,
yes,
structured objects. And it seems in recent years there's been an increasing amount of evidence that some of that shaping is actually due to jets being ejected from what would actually be a white dwarf at the centre of this planetary nebulae, and possibly also associated with the fact that maybe a large number of these things have got binary star systems at the middle. Mm. So again, it's the same...
stirring things up.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. So, I mean, interestingly, one of the interesting things that we found in this case is that the white dwarf itself, I mentioned that we modelled this in 1985 and we looked at the shock waves producing the X-ray emission. One of the interesting things we found is that, surprising things we found, that was that after about three or four weeks, although we think the X-ray emission in that first 3 or 4 weeks was probably caused by this shock heated stuff, this hot gas, after that, the X-ray emission brightened massively, suddenly brightened by a huge amount, you know, two orders of magnitude, a few hundred times brighter. And we were a little bit taken aback by that at first.
yeah, that was unexpected.
It was a little bit unexpected. But in fact, we should have expected it, really, because that's actually, we think, is the actually us seeing the hot white dwarf. So where the nuclear explosion has taken place on the surface of the white dwarf, we think we're actually getting to see the hot white dwarf itself, where the nuclear explosion occurred. And that itself is a very bright source of X-rays.
Why wouldn't you have seen it before? What's stopping you seeing it?
That's a good question. We're working out the details of that as we speak.
Good. Okay.
So that will be published in another paper in the future. So,
work in progress.
Yeah,
excellent.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think just to finish off with a sort of prediction for the future, maybe for this.
Very good. Yes, let's hear a prediction.
One of the interesting questions about these things. It turns out, I mentioned early on that this process of gathering hydrogen gas from this companion and it building up and you're getting an explosion, and maybe I sort of briefly mentioned that might take thousands of years. Now, clearly in this case we had an explosion 21 years ago.
Mm, yeah.
The time before that we had an explosion 18 years before that, 9 years before that, 25 years before that.
Mm, mm.
So in fact we're getting an explosion, you know, relatively often.
Mm.
So it seems that in this particular system, and there's several others like it, the explosion takes place much more often. There's basically two types of novae that we talk about in this case. We talk about classical novae, which are the case where we only see one explosion.
Right.
And maybe there'll be another one in maybe 10,000 years or something.
Okay.
But obviously,
yep,
we've only seen one at the moment in recorded history. And then we call them recurrent novae, simply because they've been seen to have more than one outburst. And there's presumably a continuum of behaviour in terms of the outburst periods, you know, how often you get one of these outbursts.
Right.
So it must be something, it seems that it'll be something to do with the rate at which you gather hydrogen gas from the companion, and to do with the mass of the white dwarf, it turns out. So the higher the mass of the white dwarf itself that this hydrogen is building up on, the higher the pressure at the base of the layer that builds up, if you can imagine that, because the force of gravity will be higher. So what would happen is you would reach the conditions for the explosion to occur quicker on the case of a high mass white dwarf than you would on a low mass white dwarf.
Right, because because it's such a higher mass, yeah, gravity is higher, you're, yeah, crushing everything together,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
that much more,
yeah,
closely, and therefore you get a, yeah, an explosion more,
yeah,
often.
Yeah. So it seems that the models suggest, models of this explosion suggest, that the white dwarf in Arecibo Fuchi is actually very close to what we call which is to the upper limit of mass that a white dwarf can have before it would collapse, basically. That's called the Chandrasekhar mass,
right,
which is about 1.4 solar masses, so about 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. And it looks like the RSF white dwarf must be very close to that limit. Now, if you get to that limit, then basically we expect that you get a collapse. The pressure increases inside the white dwarf, and that actually starts thermonuclear reactions within the body of the white dwarf, which lead rapidly to an explosion which completely destroys the white dwarf.
Right.
So instead of having an explosion on its surface, blowing off these outer layers, this process of gathering material starts again, another explosion occurs in another 20 years. what would happen is the white dwarf would be completely destroyed in a supernova explosion.
Right.
And that's what we think is the origin of things we call type 1A supernovae.
Okay, so you pile on so much mass onto the white dwarf that it just can't take it anymore, and it collapses in big supernova explosion, and that's it. No more novae.
Absolutely, that would be one idea for this. And so one of the big important remaining questions, I think, for Arisofuki is the amount of mass, is the mass of the white dwarf increasing or not? Now,
right.
If you can imagine, you're dumping stuff on. And you're blowing stuff off again in the explosion. Now, if it turns out that you're dumping more stuff on every time than you are blowing off, then the mass of the white dwarf will gradually be increasing.
Right.
And so it's going to get closer and closer and closer to this limit. And at some point in the future, there'll be this gigantic supernova explosion, and there'll be no more Arisofuki outbursts after that, because there'll be no white dwarf to accrete the material on.
Right. But presumably that would mean, because the white dwarf is slowly getting more and more massive, then the time between successive outbursts will be getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you'd imagine that, but in fact, we're probably talking about. It certainly seems to be that the period is not. It's not. You don't see that. You don't see evidence for that in the observations, basically. And of course, the amount by which the mass of the white dwarf increases each time is only a tiny fraction of its actual mass.
Right.
So even if that were going to be true, if everything else was the same, if the rate at which you gathered material was exactly the same all the time, even then it would be quite a small fractional increase in the period. So it seems that there's more variation than that due to maybe variations in the rate at which material is gathered, I guess.
So one outburst could be particularly exciting, couldn't it? It could all of a sudden be, oh, it's now 18 years after the last one, or kabang, it's a supernova, not a nova.
That's right, and it'd be quite a bit brighter than
quite a bit brighter.
Yeah, so that would be quite exciting. It'd certainly be a naked eye visibility star then.
Oh, very exciting.
Yeah.
What would be left after that? Would it be the white dwarf would have become a remnant of some kind? Would be,
I think, completely destroyed. In fact, in that case, yeah. So
you wouldn't have anything like a neutron star, or a pulsar, or even a black hole afterwards.
No, I don't think so. Or at least we don't believe so. Because the question remaining about what would happen to the companion star, whether the companion star would be ripped apart in that explosion or not as well, it may well be. At the moment, it clearly does survive the explosions on the white dwarf, although it's probably going to be affected by it a bit, heated up, bloated in some way, but then probably settled back down again sometime after the explosion.
Right.
So at the moment, we're just now following the explosion to its ultimate conclusion. So this stuff's expanding out. We had a look recently with the Hubble Space Telescope just last week, in fact, just to see if we could, we haven't got the data back yet from that, but just to see if we could spot the expanding material in the optical, in fact, because obviously at some point it's going to expand out far enough that the Hubble Space Telescope should be able to image it. Obviously 2 weeks after the explosion we had to use a radio telescope to do that, because they give us the sort of sharpest images, the most zoomed in, most magnified views, if you like.
There's a lovely series of images in radio just showing over time how the shell, this explosion, is expanding outwards. How much longer will you be able to do this before it becomes too big, too faint?
Yeah, what you have to do is you have to change what instruments you're using, typically. So we've already moved away from using these, what we call VLBI, which is the very long baseline interferometry, which is the acronym we have for this, where we have telescopes spread across continents. So in fact, the first image was taken with the VLBA, the very long baseline array in the USA. The second image taken a week after that was taken with the European VLBI network, which actually has the telescopes here at Jodrell Bank, and it has telescopes across many European countries. And in fact, it includes two telescopes in China and another telescope in South Africa.
Right, very European.
Yeah, so we're very inclusive. And then we followed it again with the VLBA for a few more epochs. So in fact, the last images we took with that were in May. We've also been following it with Merlin, which is the network of telescopes in the UK. They're spread across a smaller distance, just within the confines of the UK, about 200 kilometres. And so what they see, because they're not spread out as far, they won't see the very tiny structures. But as that sort of shockwave expands, it becomes possible for us to sort of image the shape and structure of it with Merlin.
Right.
And so we move over from these very extended arrays to the more compact arrays, and we can still follow the evolution of structure. And we were doing that up until very recently with Merlin, and we're continuing now to do it with the VLA, which is the very large array in New Mexico, which is even more compact than Merlin is.
Right.
But as the thing gets larger, you can switch from one array to another and follow the thing out. The story is still continuing, and will do for probably a few months yet. In the X-ray, we're hoping to sort of see the shockwave again.
Yeah.
So the shockwave was there initially, and then it got sort of swamped by this bright, what we think is probably the white dwarf, the Hulk white dwarf. But then as that's faded, then the shockwave should become apparent again. So if we're interested in the whole story, then we want to sort of follow it through to see how things eventually end up, and see if we can perhaps compare the conditions after the explosion to maybe what the conditions were earlier. Maybe it'll give us a clue as to this question of whether the white dwarf is increasing in mass or not.
Right, very exciting. I suppose it's a neat thing to be looking at, because you kind of got a... You're going to get something else in another 20 years' time, aren't you? It's going to go... You know.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean we just sit in our offices and twiddle our thumbs for 20 years, honestly. but it's interesting. I mean, it was interesting for me in the sense that, you know, everybody remembers what they did in their PhD.
Right,
so even though it was a good long 21 years ago, I still just about remember that. So, in fact, we had models that I developed at that time that you can test directly with these observations now. Mm. So that's, you know, a matter of personal interest, let alone the sort of astrophysical interest of this object. And funnily enough, of course, it turns out that, you know, we got it wrong. To some extent, we got it wrong last time round, because we modelled the X-rays without including this hot white dwarf component. So I just looked at the shockwaves, and it turns out that certainly for parts of the X-ray spectrum, for the sort of lower energy X-rays, you really have to include the white dwarf as well.
Right.
Luckily, we mentioned it as an afterthought in one of our papers.
Right.
In the discussion of one of the papers that we probably want to include that, and maybe that would actually be an important contributor. It turns out that that is the case, so we just got away with that, possibly.
It's very exciting to think that how technology has improved over the last 20 years since the last outburst. What could be possible in the next 20 years?
Yeah.
What instruments would be available, and what improvements in computing and modelling will be available by then?
The two major instruments that we've been using in the radio and X-ray part of the spectrum. In the radio, we've used the VLBA and EVN, European Network. Neither of those were really operational in anything like... So VLBA certainly wasn't. EVN was a very early stage, so that just wouldn't have been possible then to take these radio images of the shockwave at such an early stage. In the X-ray... Although the Exosat satellite looked at it sort of five or six times. The first observation was 55 days after the explosion. This time round, we were onto it within a couple of days.
Yes.
And we've used the SWIFT satellite in particular, which is designed to look at gamma ray bursts. So it was designed as a satellite that could very rapidly slew round and point at a gamma ray burst, which are very unexpected and rapidly changing events. The telescope has to be a very quick responding, hence the name SWIFT.
Yes.
We've basically used that many, many times. The NASA team that operates SWIFT have been very good to us. In the case of Iris Ophiuchi, it's a very, very interesting object they recognised. And so in between gamma ray bursts, we've basically been getting observations of Iris Ophiuchi. So there's a huge database. And in fact, with that, we've discovered, you know, several major new phenomena, in fact, with the SWIFT satellite that we wouldn't have got if we hadn't observed it very regularly and very rapidly from the beginning and followed the thing all the way through. So it's quite important to have facilities available to you that you can sort of use, you know, on a very regular basis over a period of time. So it's this sort of idea of time variable astronomy,
right,
and sort of transient events. And I mean, as you know, in your own research on planet discoveries.
Yeah, the universe doesn't stay the same.
No, that's right. And to pick up these events that are short-lived, in your case, like the spikes due to planets in the light curves of these sort of lens stars, then you know, you have to have a network of telescopes that's capable of observing at a reasonably regular rate of knots, basically.
Yeah. Well, very exciting stuff, and
yeah,
thank you very much indeed for talking about it.
Yeah, no problem.